Greetings, Goombas. It's me, the Reverend Godfather, here to introduce you to several of the interviews we had almost a month ago. But first, I'm going to give you a little disclaimer. Due to several disagreements and misunderstandings between me and the promoter of the event we went to, you're going to hear a couple of cuts in the interviews, some of the interviews. Each one has, I think, at least one cut in it. To tell you from a show standpoint, I don't like to do cuts or remove stuff from the episodes because you're missing out on stuff, you the listener. But in this case, it had to be done. The only editing I do in reference to the shows themselves are to boost the audio so you could hear the people I'm interviewing, the people I'm speaking with, so forth and so on. But from there, let's continue on with the show. First up is Matt McGone. I hope, Matt, if you're listening, I hope you are. Please forgive me for mispronouncing your name. He's a YouTuber. He goes on YouTube. He's known as Matt3756. The link to his channel will be in the show description. But for those of you who are not checking, just search for Matt. It's spelled M-A-T-T. And it's the number is 3756. So just search for Matt, M-A-T-T, 3756 in the YouTube search bar. And it'll come up with his channel. He was a great interview. He does a type of Let's Play for arcade machines, the skill-based machines. I'll let him explain what he does, what it's like to be a YouTuber, how YouTube is affecting, cutting the cable cord, what it's like to be a YouTuber, and let's go from there and let's hear the interview. Hey Goombas, I'm here kind of undercover, so to speak. You probably would be hearing our total review earlier this month at our Hostful, but right now I'm here with...
Hey, what's up guys? My name's Matt Magnone, aka Matt3756. If you don't know who I am a YouTuber who does videos about claw machines and arcade games. You know, those claw games from like Toy Story, The Claw. Yeah, I do videos on those. I give you tips on how to win at them, how they work. We go to different arcades. We also play ticket games. I've even been expanding my videos to mini golf, and it's just a fun time we have on my channel.
Even though you're a YouTuber, do you classify yourself as a Let's Player, like with the video game Let's Players, or something different?
I would say no, because I'm trying to branch out a little bit from the typical Let's Play video. There's so many video game channels on YouTube. I mean, you got Minecraft channels, and not downplaying them, there's just so many of them that I want to come across as like a different genre, a new thing.
Let's Player, so to
different,
speak.
Yeah, exactly.
So would you consider yourself a pioneer in that, or one of the first few that you know of?
Well, I don't know about a pioneer, but I've been signed up with YouTube actually since 2006, and
which would have been my next question,
right?
How long you've been doing this?
Yeah, so a long time, but my channel didn't start as Claw Machine Arcade. It was just a hub to kind of upload all my random weird videos that I would film, and how it took off was I uploaded a Tips of the Claw Machine video, like giving tips on the game and how to win at it, and I got a lot of positive feedback. People were like, hey, your tips are working, and I'm like, oh, this is strange. So, from there, I just kind of branched out. You know, a couple years later, about around 2011 or 2012 is when it really started to get serious, and I took it full time. So it was then when I decided to dedicate my channel full time to arcade and claw machine videos.
I with a lot of the bigger names like MatPat, and nothing against someone like PewDiePie or something like that, or whatever you want to pronounce his name. When was the first time you said, in essence, oh shit, this is actually becoming something?
I'd probably say when I got partnered with YouTube, which was actually more exclusive than it is now, meaning you can revenue share and make money off your videos. Now they pretty much opened the doors to anybody. Before, you had to have a very strict viewer monthly consistent viewership and all that to get in. I actually got denied my first time, reapplied later again in the year, and I was like, whoa. And then after that, I noticed that my subscriber base started growing a lot quicker than it had prior to, and I'm like, wow, this is crazy. So, you know, when I hit 100,000 subscribers and it just kept growing, my summer months are usually the best for views because I have a lot of a younger audience and kids are off school, people are, you know, on vacation and whatever. So, you know, I'd say around 2012, 2013, it just like it blew up, and I'm like, wow, this is crazy.
With that aspect of YouTube opening up its doors, so to speak, to everybody, and everybody nowadays, as it was a few years ago and a few years prior to that, when fewer and fewer people back then had less cameras, now everybody has a camera some way, somehow, and the capability to upload to YouTube. Yeah. How does that affect you as a YouTuber, or do you welcome the competition saying, hey, come on, let's see what you got?
I welcome it. You know, I actually have, there are some other YouTubers that have, you know, I guess been inspired by me maybe, that have branched out and done arcade and claw channels, and I'm all for them, really. I think it's more of, like I've said in my Draw My Life video, it's more about community and less about competition, you know, because we can all share. They can go and play different machines that I can't access, and vice versa. So I welcome it, and I'm glad. You know, I think my niche is kind of like a refreshing little niche slash genre for YouTube, you know, and I think it's
with the word of YouTube Red coming out, their subscribable service, I've been hearing different things about YouTube Red in reference to what it is. How does that affect you in a way, or do you know?
Since it's so new, I haven't noticed anything, but the past couple of days of my analytics, I haven't noticed anything drastic or different in my earnings or viewership or what have you, but I think a lot of the YouTubers were worried about it. I was at first, but after reading about more about truly what it is, it's really not going to impact you, and YouTube is still all about people supporting the creators that they enjoy, you know, even with the paid service with no ads. So they're still working it in how we are able to get compensated if somebody is on YouTube Red and instead of the typical ad way. So I'm not at all worried. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's only going to help us in the long run for people that don't want to watch the ads. You know, they subscribe, but we'll still get a fair share.
Because you're the first YouTuber I'm able to have a sit down, our show has been able to have a sit down with and talk with.
No, nice.
I was wondering, because I've noticed as an up and coming podcaster, I've noticed that there are still people in the, I won't say not so much the podcasting, YouTubing industry, but when I say, hey, I'm so-and-so representing this podcast, I get that stigmata of, oh, really? Like, I just wiped my hand, you know, without toilet paper, and it's like, oh, dear God. As a YouTuber, have you seen that same type of reaction, or is it something different?
No, not that I know of. Like for me, personally, I welcome anybody. I don't care how many followers they have, big, small, whatever. I'm all for anybody trying to get into the internet world, is whether they want to do it as a hobby or do it full-time like I do. I welcome it all. I really do.
Me personally, as a podcast, I see the YouTuber community, like yourself, as the internet TV equivalent to what I do in reference to radio. I am radio on demand. You guys are TV on demand,
right, exactly.
In bite-sized chunks.
Yeah.
Even though they can listen to me anywhere they're driving, they could watch you in the office. They could watch you at home on the console or wherever. It's still TV, an alternate version of TV. Do you see that as a YouTuber?
Yeah, definitely. It's really interesting how it's evolved. You know, I myself personally don't even watch TV anymore. Like, I watch Netflix. It's on demand. I have Netflix and YouTube. That's it. You know, I think we live in a society today, you know, not necessarily a bad thing, but people want stuff now. They don't want to wait for, you know, their show to come on at 8 o'clock or whatever. Or, you know, like, and people like the fact that they could just hop on YouTube and watch videos for a minute or an hour or all day, you know.
Now, I was speaking with you as you were kind of mentioning it, and it's almost like YouTube's the, you're still, to me, you're young. It's the public access. It's the modern day public access channel.
Yeah.
Even though some locations still have public access where you pay a fee,
right.
In this case, YouTube's paying you as you grow.
Right, exactly.
So it is public access, mm-hmm. You know, but people are with YouTubers such as yourself, PewDiePie, Matt Pack, the whole nine yards.
Mm-hmm.
You guys are just riding that wave, saying, hey, we're enjoying this. Come in, like you said, come in, enjoy the ride.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I take it day by day. You know, this is all kind of like a by accident thing. I went to college for media arts, TV video, so it kind of ties in with what I'm doing, like with YouTube and making videos and all that, and it does help with editing and what have you. But, you know, had I been doing this, I probably would be doing, like, something with movie work or TV or something, but this kind of took off, and like you said, I'm just kind of enjoying the ride.
Me, as a podcast, I have to, you know, I didn't have that class as media, learning to edit and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find yourself, like, I'm learning now, having to learn a lot of things on the fly doing this?
Well, I will say this, I mean, I love the school that I went to, but I knew about 80% of the stuff before I went there. A lot of the stuff I self-taught, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go on YouTube and learn anything these days, or just type it in Google and it'll tell you how to do it, you know. But it does help to be familiar with the editing niche, you know. It does make it easier.
I know with the recording software, each software has its own nuances.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been finding that with what I have to do, it's, all right, now go do it. Son of a bitch, now I gotta learn this.
Yeah,
and it's like,
yeah.
And
well, that's the thing, you know, technology is always evolving, and that's the one thing about that I think that college didn't focus on enough was the technology aspect, as to where we weren't learning, you know, the ins and outs of how the cameras work and stuff like that. And, right, when I was there, we still had the old CRT, like for previews in the video studio. You know, they were old clunky CRT, could very fuzzy, you know, monitors. They upgraded, of course, after I left to LCD, and everything was all fancy. But yeah, I mean, the technology is always changing, and you have to be on top of it. Otherwise, you know, you're just gonna have to. It's like relearning a whole new thing.
Yeah, with the whole aspect that you can do either a lot of stuff that both of us can do online. It's now easier, more readily available, that more people are able to do it. Do you see that something like YouTube having a bubble and it bursting anytime soon?
I'm not quite sure.
Meaning, like, back in the early part of the 2000s, there was that internet bubble, so to speak, that everybody and their uncle had something to sell, had their own .com, and by 2002, it kind of went pop, and everything just, only a few sites like YouTube, Google, Yahoo, and Amazon, and eBay kind of just were strong enough to survive. Do you see that now with the YouTube market?
No, I mean, I think it's kind of like a different market with in regards to, because it is video related, I think it's kind of just like, I look at it as like a next wave of, you know, radio, TV, and then now you have internet video. So I really don't see, and YouTube is still very young. I mean, it's about, what, 10 years? And that it might seem like a long time, but, in reality of things, it's actually still very, very young.
Do you see, do you see it lasting, that bubble lasting a little bit longer, because a lot of people now are cutting their cable and dish cord, and they're going towards sites like YouTube, Hulu, Netflix, and so forth and so on for that media intake?
Yeah, I think it's a good thing. you know, because like I said before, people are shifting towards that on demand, they want it now type thing. And quite frankly, a lot of people, including myself, are just tired of paying the outrageous cable fees. You know, you have to get to pay this to just to get this one channel that you like. You know, people, you can't just order channel by channel, unfortunately.
Which you can get with Netflix and Hulu.
Right.
Granted,
there's
you have to certain shows you have the season pass.
Right.
But
even if you subscribe to literally all of them, YouTube Red now, Netflix, Hulu, all the other, you know, video sites, you could, Amazon Prime has their own free video thing as well, it's still probably cheaper than cable, and you're still going to get a lot more. You know, even some stuff that might not be on cable at all might be available on one of those sites.
I know my co-host, the only thing he clipped his cord. He said the only thing he misses is like ESPN. Mm-hmm. He said, but because he's a big Caps fan, all he has to do is open up his phone, go to the Caps app, and listen to their broadcast, their radio broadcast, over his phone.
Yeah.
So it's there's always that additional option. And he said, what I couldn't watch on TV with a Caps game, I could still listen to it because they're always broadcasting it over the app.
Right.
So, again, do you find... let me rephrase this. What's your main demographic for your channel? Is it all ages or mostly the younger kids?
Well, I do have a lot of younger kids, but what's interesting is I do have a lot of older folks as well, or people my age and even older. Like, the claw machine and arcade niche is something that, like, literally everybody can enjoy. Because you see people playing the claw game. They could be 3.93. You know, it's such a simple game that it grasps literally everybody. And what's interesting is I do like just some meetups and stuff with some of my viewers and whatnot, and I've had fans that were, you know, 3 years old, all the way from fans to my age or even older. And it's interesting to meet the older fans too, because it's like, wow, you know, you think, oh, just little kids like these games.
I know
whatever.
Some of the stuff that's on your table is like Dave and Buster's and so forth and so on. Have you seen, even though the local mall here has a arcade in it, do you see that arcade? I'm excluding Dave and Buster's, nothing against places like them.
Right.
Are you seeing the arcade kind of, even though it was for a while, it was kind of disappearing, do you still see it disappearing, or is it making a comeback?
Well, I'd like to say that I hope that I'm a reason to maybe help make it come back, partially. With my videos, I hope that it's getting people interested again in the whole thing, and like kind of re-energizing their love for, you know, and passion for arcade games. This is a bit collectible, like toys and whatnot. And a lot of people that grow older want their toys that they had in the 70s and the 80s and whatnot. So I'm hoping I'm doing the same for the arcade genre, that people, you know, get interested again and want to visit their local arcades and, you know, pop a few quarters in the claw game and whatever. But
do you find that the fact that something like the claw game, the whole aspect of the skee ball, I had one friend that said, skee ball, that's American. You can't play, if you haven't played skee ball, you're un-American. Do you play skee ball, or is it part of the what you
check?
Or it's a little bit of.
I'm not very good at it, but I've played.
Who isn't? Who is good at it?
There are some people that are really. In fact, my one friend, his name's Mike, and he's a friend back where I live in Pittsburgh. I meet up with him at Dave and Buster's sometimes, and he's really good. Like, he has that muscle memory, hand-eye coordination, where he's more good at, like, the physical games, like the football throwing game and the skee ball, where he can pop it in at 10,000 almost, like, every time. So
he could have that. He knows how to put the English on the ball.
Exactly, yeah. So there are definitely people out there like that that are good at those.
Like that one YouTuber, all he's doing was one hand, and everyone is just sinking.
Exactly, yep.
I bet even something like that, you're like, son of a bitch, how the frick is he doing that shit?
Yeah.
The hell?
Yeah, it's crazy. I was surprised, you know, because like I said, I'm not very hand-eye, but I was never really good in sports. So. But yeah, it's amazing. Some people have it, and they just, you know, he's really good. Like the football, I mean, his hand-eye coordination is amazing. Like, he can get that football in that little target. You know, it's a really hard arcade game for the average person, but he nails it like it's nothing.
For those who don't, might have not seen, I'll put a link to your channel in our show's description. For those who know about the claw machines and so forth, because they're everywhere from Buffalo Wild Wings to malls to some stores. What's the common misconceptions that a lot of people have about those machines?
That's a really good question, actually. And the common misconception is that they're all rigged, and that's not true. Vox.com had a really viral video and article, and they used some of my footage. And in my one video on my channel, I'm thrilled they did. I'm sick of, but what they focused on was only the negative side of the claw game. They focused on the newer machines, which, as technology evolves, they have microprocessors and whatnot, so they can have it so the claw adjusts the voltage without the operator being there. So it'll pay out a prize only maybe 1 in 20 or 1 in 30 plays and whatnot. But the fact of the matter is, there are still plenty of machines out there that are older meaning like pre 1990s, that are skill-based, whereas they just have one little, whether it be like a little potentiometer inside that you turn to adjust the voltage, or just a little box that sets the percentage of the claw strength. Once the owner sets that, they can't change that, so it's a constant strength. So if it's a constant strength, it's a skill-based game, whereas it's not just luck, you know. So there is a lot of skill involved, actually, and I've proved that time and time again on my videos, where somewhere I've won 20, 30 prizes in one video.
I know I heard reports in reference to the old school, put a coin in, put a quarter, it's the plow-based games, that some of them had alarms attached to it. And the stories, I'll drop the podcast, it's from the Nerdist. He said he went to one arcade where they had that, and instead of pushing out tickets, you actually got quarters. All the machines had...
Oh, yeah, the quarter pushers.
Yeah, and all the machines had alarms attached, which means if you bumped it, an alarm went off saying somebody's trying to cheat the machine.
Yeah.
And they found out one machine didn't have... The alarm was broken. So they managed to constantly... He said it was like him and maybe three other people knew that machine did not have an alarm attached to it, so they would hit that machine up and spend all day in the arcade.
Wow.
But speaking of cheating, are some of the myths amongst the claw-based or the skill-based machines that the cheating is there, or is there something else behind it? Is that a myth or what?
The cheating, or as I like to call the newer machines, rigged.
Yeah.
They are rigged, some of them, and unfortunately.
But what am I talking about? Is the player able to cheat the machine so they can get a better chance at winning a prize?
No, but there's different strategies, and I do divulge them on my channel that a lot of people probably wouldn't think to do. Something as simple as looking to the side of the machine, and what I like to call using your angles when going for a prize, because it is a 3D game. A lot of people, when I watch them, they just play it straight on and they're going for a prize, and you might look like you're lined up horizontally, but if you turn to the side, you might realize, oh my gosh, I'm too far forward, or I'm too far, you know, back. More than I thought I was. So, you know, just something as simple as that. There was a technique in one machine where the company stacks the plush stadium style, meaning low in the front and high in the back. Well, me, and I don't know how many other people would think to do this, would maneuver the claw behind the plush in the back and pull the claw forward, just not dropping the claw, but just pulling it forward and kind of raking in all that plush, and they would just tumble in the prize chute. And I have several videos on my channel where I do that as well. So it's not cheating, but it's a strategy that I think maybe your average person wouldn't think to do, I guess is what I'm trying to get at.
I want to... We have a lot of great... It's been a great interview. I want to see if, as soon as the other people show up, get them as well. It's been great speaking with you.
Yeah,
I'll put a link to your channel in our show description. And once this episode drops, I'll probably through YouTube, our YouTube channel.
I'll give you my card if you want
to
send it to me. I'll reshare this with
No problem. And that way, hopefully, through us, you'll get at least a few more. I don't know how many.
Likewise.
Either way, cross promotion's always great. Again, thank you. Nice meeting with you.
My pleasure.
I'll probably see you around.
I'll be here.
Welcome back, Goombas. It's me again. Just wanted to let you know, that was Matt Magone. I hope you enjoyed that interview. Next up is the legendary actor, sci-fi actor, that's S-C-I-F-I, sci-fi actor Conrad Brooks. Some of you film buffs might remember him in the original Plan 9 from Outer Space, the Edward classic. He's been in a lot of movies, and the only thing he asks you, the fans, is to write him. I think he might have a Facebook page that is run by his daughter. I think he told me that once before, but I don't know if that's still up, so don't hold me to that, fans. But what he does ask is send him a letter. He does give his P.O. box in the interview, so jot that down. You could send him some fan mail. He looked so lonely at this show, he also said if you send him some money, like $20, something like that, he'll send you something signed or what have you. Just let him know, or just email, write to him and converse back and forth. What more can I say? I'll let him do the talking for him. Here we go.
Hey, folks, I'm back. I'm here with Mr.
Conrad Brooks, the guy who did quite a few bad films in Hollywood. And also, I'm working on some good ones.
And what movie are you best known for? The Edwards movie Plan 9?
Yeah, I did a film called Plan 9 from Outer Space, which is considered the worst film of all times. But now, people love it. It's famous now. It grossed into millions of dollars. It's a low-budget film. We made the film back in 1956. Ed Wood directed it. And now Walt Disney, Tim Burton, produced a film called Ed Wood, starring Johnny Depp. I'm in the film also. Martin Landau, who played Bela Lugosi, in the film as well. So it's a great little film, and Martin Landau won the Academy Award for playing Bela Lugosi in the Ed Wood film. Tim Burton directed it and put out by Walt Disney. It's a great little film. And it's based on Ed Wood, who did Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Not only have you known for acting movies, a lot of Ed Wood movies,
yes.
You've done a lot of movies yourself. What have you done?
Oh, I've done over 200 films in Hollywood. Now, of course, with Ed Wood, I did Sinister Urge, Bride of the Monster, and what else did I do? You know, I'm 85. You forget certain things. Glen O'Glenda, my first film with Ed Wood, 1952. And great stuff. I've been in Hollywood for 55 years. I'm living here in West Virginia now. And I'm producing my own films here now. And I'm producing independent films. And you can contact me. My P.O. box, okay, with the P.O. box?
Yeah.
264 Inwood, West Virginia, and the zip code 25428. And contact me, send me a money order, or personal check will be fine. And I've made these films, any of the films I appeared in. Misfit Patrol, Little Old Sea Serpent, for other motion picture directors. You can contact me. It'd be good to hear from you. And let's see, what else? What else we got to talk about? Early in the morning now.
Do you see, with a lot of the independent filmmakers, again, like yourself, do you see that being a resurgence nowadays with...
I tell you, yeah, why not? I mean, if you're interested in doing something, do it, bad or good, do it. If it's in your heart to do it,
So you encourage a lot of the younger artists...
Why not? If you're capable and got a couple of bucks, do it. Hey, enjoy it. That's the important thing,
If he was alive today, would Ed Wood be considered an indie filmmaker or still?
Well, probably, yeah, more or less, I would think so. You know, today, it's a lot of independent stuff being shot today. Years ago, Paramount, Monogram, Warner Brothers, they would produce the films and release it through their companies. And now, a lot of films are being made, like you say, independent stuff, and being released by other distributors, you know. I don't recall who, you know. I occasionally do work in films, you know, my age. You know, if you got a job for me, look me up, write me a letter.
Do you find it's easier for an independent maker to make a movie now than it has been a couple of years ago?
I won't say easy. Nothing's easy, you know. But the only thing is, make sure you got a decent script. That's the most important thing. Have a decent script. And trying to get some actors with a name, you know, if you can afford it, you know. Or work a deal out with them, you know.
So you've been to a lot of... I noticed that you have a Chiller Theater badge on you right now.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The Chiller in New York. Actually, New Jersey. And I did the Monster Bash in Pittsburgh just recently. And I did the one in Baltimore, Hunt Valley, where we did the show. It's called...
Was it Horrifying? Or is it under a different name now?
Let me think. You caught me off guard early in the morning, kid. Mid-Atlantic.
Mid-Atlantic?
Yes. Yeah.
Do you have fun going to these shows?
Yeah, I meet the fans. People remember me from watching these movies I'm in. Yeah, it's always nice to meet people that remember you, you know. It brings back a lot of good memories, you know.
What else can I ask? A legend of
whatever you want to ask me, kid.
What are some of your memories working in the film industry way back in the early days?
Oh, just about everything, you know. But the memory, I got a good memory.
Is there anything you could share with us in regards to those?
Like what? Give me an example.
Whatever you wish.
You're a fan. What do you want to know? You're representing your company.
All right, with Plan 9, because that's the most...
Plan 9, yes. Well, actually, yeah, but of course I remember doing Plan 9. I was 5 days on the show, and I remember I only got $500. Now, $500, and that was big money in those days, because I remember my rent was only $35. My phone bill was $3. You can buy a steak dinner for $2.95, $4.95. Nowadays, you buy a steak dinner, it's like a bone practically, and costs you $40-$50. You know, it's crazy.
So the shooting schedule for Plan 9 was only about 5 days?
Low budget.
As compared to like a 30-day shoot nowadays, or?
Well, 30 days, yeah, it costs you a lot of money now. See, I remember, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think Ed Wood spent about, I could be wrong, you know. I never consulted him. I was just an actor. I didn't care what the picture cost, whether it cost $30,000 or $20,000. I wasn't interested, because I didn't have that kind of money to worry about. I think he spent around 25,000.
Which by today would be about $100,000 or more.
More, yeah. I mean, now to shoot a third film, you know, 35 millimeter, it's not cheap, you know.
No. Yeah, everything now is, how do you, speaking of going from actually 35 millimeter to digital, what do you...
It's cheaper.
Cheaper.
I imagine cheaper. I don't know, you know. Who knows? You know.
So,
I produce my films on video, you know. we call it Gypsy Vampire. Gypsy Vampire, Jengal, the Beast from the East. That's a great one.
And, well, we have a couple of things that we got to do in reference to the show. It's been great interviewing you.
Are you going to leave me?
If you want me to hang out for a little while, I could come back.
Yeah, come back. Well, I like you, Chris. I mean, I like doing your show, man. Yeah, come back anytime, Chris.
Okay. Just in case I don't swing by.
What I'm going to suggest to you.
Hey folks, again we're back. That was the legendary Conrad Brooks. I hope you enjoyed his interview. Next up is an interview, I believe he said his name was Jay. He was not Jay from the Skeleton Crew and Comic Crypt, different Jay. This is Jay from the 501st, who we had the pleasure of interviewing for a little while. But the thing is, midway through our interview, we were cut off and asked to leave. But again, editor's note, see the episode entitled Wondering Where the Reviews Are, and to hear the full story of what happened. But either way, here's the interview with the 501st and the whole aspect of that.
Hi guys, we're back again. This time we're with the 501st. I'm going to look at Jay.
Yes.
He's with the
501st Legion, Vader's Fist. We are a international costuming organization that is sanctioned by Lucasfilm and Disney. All of our costumes are screen accurate, so basically everything you see our members wearing is screen accurate. We have very high standards. Our sister organization, the Rebel Legion, does the, well, they call themselves the good guys, but you know, what can I say about that?
You guys were a part of, and now as of the prequels canon, was that recently with the prequels, or were you considered canon prior to that with the expanded universe?
The 501st members, it started in 1997, basically. Alvin Johnson was the founder of the 501st Legion. And that at that time, we were sanctioned and we were authorized by Lucasfilm at the time, and now Disney. We've always been canon. Now, the expanded universe, according to Disney, because they now own the rights to everything, is now non-canon. There are rare exceptions that are canon, but most of the expanded universe is non-canon now. So it's, you can still use those costumes, but they're not going to be considered a canon costume.
What is the... I know you explained what the 501st is, but you said, from what I got out of the 501st through Facebook and internet, you guys are a charitable organization. Can you tell us about what 501st does?
Absolutely, absolutely. The 501st Legion is, we're an international costuming group. We are not a charity ourselves, but we support other charity groups. We're, I believe, in over 47 countries across the world. We have over 7,000 members worldwide. If I remember correctly, last year our total amount raised for different charities was right around $14 million. Don't quote me specifically on that. I'm just trying to pull that out of my mind real quick. But we do charity work for charities. We don't usually do social gatherings. If you're having a birthday party, we're probably not going to be able to show up to your birthday party in your home. But there are public functions that we come out to and help support other charities by bringing the Star Wars name and bringing our unique skill set to that.
Like Make-A-Wish, for example.
Exactly. Make-A-Wish Foundation is one of our major... We really support Make-A-Wish Foundation. There's dozens of different charities. Each kind of group within the 501st is broken up into garrisons. Those are the different areas. Each garrison kind of usually has their own little specialty or their own little the group that they specifically support. But for the most part, it's mostly children's charities we focus on.
What does it take for someone to become a member of the 501st?
Well, they've got to be a bad guy to begin with. It's just that's the given. No, all kidding aside, the 501st is our tagline is bad guys doing good. You have to have an approvable imperial costume. And to get more information on that, you can go to 501st501st.com, and you can see under the different detachments, all the different kinds of costumes. You can do everything from clone troopers to stormtroopers to sand troopers to TIE pilots to Jawas to Boba Fetts to all kinds of different organizations. Now, our sister organization, which are the Rebel Legion, they're always going to be the good guys. They're kind of boring. They have the Wookiees and the Jedis and all those goofy people. And then we also have another sister organization called the Mandalorian Mercs. They're going to be like the mercenaries, the Boba Fett kind of. Where Boba Fett's more mainstream 501st, there is the support organization of the Mandalorian Mercs. And they each group has their own requirements for membership and costuming. But for the 501st, there's a costume resource library you have to go through, and it tells you specifically what your costume has to have and how it has to look to be approvable.
Because even though it's going to get a little bit off topic, what are you hoping for the new movie that's coming out in December?
It's going to be good. That's all. I just hope J.J. Abrams didn't mess it up. That's all I'm asking. Just don't mess it up.
What do you think about some of the fan theories that are out there, ranging from that the new Jedi Sith is anywhere from Luke Skywalker to Jar Jar himself?
I don't know how he would get the ears and the helmet, but if it works, it works. Everybody, that's the one thing about Star Wars. Having grown up as part of that Star Wars generation when the originals were coming out and all that, and having lived through and experienced the prequels and and all that, you know, everybody has their own opinion, but that's what's amazing about Star Wars, is it brings so many diverse people together into one. The fact that people are actually having conversations about this, that's what's amazing about it.
So. My experience with the Star Wars fan base, I consider myself more of a Star Wars fan base than a Star Trek fan base. More fun, and where else can you have a fan base that makes droids into kegerators? You
know? I totally forgot about the R2 Builders group. That's another one of our sister organizations I totally forgot about. Thank you for reminding me. R2 Builders group, yeah, that's another amazing group, and if you ever get a chance to go see any of their work or go on.
They were at AwesomeCon this past year and got to see they had a working R2, and I guess someone in the C-3PO unit. It seemed like somebody, but it seemed very uncomfortable. So
having worked with a true C-3PO, it is not an easy costume. Let's just say that you are literally bolted into the costume, and there's a few people I know, or there's one person that I know that does it. As soon as he gets in that costume, he is C-3PO. It is amazing the transformation that takes place.
Like I said, the Star Wars fan base is more fun and easygoing. The reason why I said is when the prequels came out, this was before the midnight releases and the 3-day before releases. Went to see here at the local, I don't know if it went to Regal at the time, it was might have been Hoyt's still, seeing first show, first day, and no sooner than the infamous scroll come up, not scroll, but long ago, it was definitely a fan. What do you mean this ain't Star Wars? And it's you.
And that's it, Goombas. Sorry it was cut off right there. There was a few, maybe about another minute or so of recording, but at that point where it was cut off is when the promoter's assistant, I believe that's who she was, came over and start kind of, again, I'm not going to go here, see the episode entitled, Wondering Whether Reviews Are, which is maybe about two episodes back, but For now, if you want to email us or anything like that, please email us at longcoatmafia@gmail.com. We are available on iTunes and on Stitcher Radio for now. We are waiting a response we hinted at it on our hostful episode. We're waiting on Google, I'm going to say it now, Google Play is going to be having our podcast on their services when they launch that. So for right now, if you want to email us, it's at longcoatmafia@gmail.com. You can find us on iTunes, like us, don't like us, just review us, and either way, we'll be on a good list. If you're listening through iTunes or Twitter or something like that, we are found at the website thelongcoatmafia.podbean.com. We are on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is longcoatmafia. We are on Instagram. Our Instagram handle is longcoatmafia. We are on YouTube, but I'm not sure what our username is. I think it's that also is longcoatmafia. But for right now, if you have any issues with this episode, please email us, so forth and so on. And we'll be happy to email you back. If we get a lot of emails in, we'll create a special episode just for those emails. And stay tuned in the next couple of weeks. And next year, we'll have a brand new intro just for the hostfuls. And a lot of goodies next year. A lot of goodies next year. All for you. All coming up. Loads of stuff. Great stuff in the works. And for right now, guess what? I'm out. See you next time.